Welcome to CraftLit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 34 of Backaches and Boxes. Well, hello there, my wee bonny lads and lasses. I've been living around a lot of bagpipes lately and felt the need to put on a completely ridiculous Scottish brogue, so there it went. Yeah, I met someone, we went on a tour of lights in a, you know, one of those hayrides with horses clopping on the street and stuff. My mom lives in a neighborhood in Tucson that is completely decorated at Christmas time to the point of being ridiculous, actually, in some places, but really quite a lot of it was lovely. And one of the women that we were riding with had been playing bagpipes since she was, I think she was 20 or 22. And it was really cool to get to talk to a bagpiper. It made me want to go find a chanter again and try and take it up at my ripe old age, which I'm telling you, they're saying is far, far too old to be taking up the pipes. So, I don't know, maybe I'll do it just to tick some people off. It kind of sounds like fun, both ticking those people off and learning how to play the bagpipes. Well, this week I have to say a huge thank you to Jen Massey, who sent me the cutest little gift. I got a little tub of chai tea with chocolate, which my six-year-old immediately tried to procure. Some really adorable Christmas tree stitch markers, which are already on my socks that I'm working on. And she sent the cutest little Santa sock for my little sock blocker. I don't know if you remember, but ages ago, it may have been back in the teens of our episodes, I talked about the feltupdesigns.com sock blocker that you can get for $2.50, and it's a little sock blocker keychain, and you can knit lots of little cute socks for the sock blocker thing. And now I have a Christmas sock for my keychain, and it's so adorable, and people are looking at it and say, oh, where did you get that? That's so cute. I want one. What do I have to do to get one? And I say, well, I guess you just have to know some really cool people. It's just beautiful, and thank you so much, Jen. I also got a rather important email from another listener. I got an email from Nina, who sent links to both a potential mosquito bite, not cure, but thing to help it, and also a really, really good hand cream. Well, it's not hand cream, foot cream, canker sore cream, you name it, cream. It's handmade, it's got no preservatives, it's all the natural stuff. It's got natural antibiotic things in it. You know, there's different kind of oils and things like that. And I'm ecstatic because if it doesn't say cream, it's not going to work on me. I have extraordinarily dry hands and feet. In fact, I'm looking at my hands right now and I'm really glad you can't see them because it's an embarrassment. You know, one of the reasons why Victorian knitting changed the handhold, instead of, try doing this with me while you're listening because it'll make more sense. If you hold your needles like most people do for knitting, you are holding the needles under your hands. You know, if you let go, gravity will pull the needles down from you. So your fingers are kind of curved under and your thumbs are facing you and on the side of the needles. In Victorian knitting, hold your needles like two pens now. In Victorian knitting, the women held their needles like pencils or pens, regardless of the fact that that made it quite difficult to go quickly, they could knit with their pinky fingers up, thus to better display their hands Victorian. It goes along with Turn of the Screw rather nicely, though. So I'm rather glad I'm not a Victorian, and I don't have to show off my hands because, dear Lord, they're a horror right now. It makes me sad. You know, I don't have short, stubby fingers, but I have thicker than thin fingers. I don't know. I'm medium boned, I guess. I'm certainly not fine, and I'm also not big. I'm stuck in the middle. And so when my fingernails are short, my fingers look much stubbier. And right now, they're not just short. They're short. They're ripped up. I have more, not paper cuts, but cardboard cuts, which you may be familiar with if you've moved in the last couple of years. You don't forget pain like that very quickly. So I'm looking forward to the cream, because at this point, I gotta do something. What else? I am still living among boxes. I have tried valiantly to upload a picture for you to show you the boxes which I am living among, and I have not been able to do this. Bloggers just thwarting me at every turn. So I'll continue to try. I will persevere, or I will persever, as my high school English teacher used to say. Whatever, whatever, we will persever. The house is coming along, though. I'm actually podcasting from the office I share with my husband, and I have to say, it's been lovely. When he's here, we put the desks so that they're facing each other, kind of a Dorothy Parker moment. Not this time I'm not misquoting and talking about, you know, Alice Roosevelt when I should be talking about Alice Roosevelt. I'm talking about Dorothy Parker. This actually is a Dorothy Parker thing. She and Peter Benchley is the guy who wrote Jaws. Now I can't remember the Benchley that she was in love with. Anyway, someone will write me and remind me what his name was. Benchley and Mrs. Parker had desks that faced each other. Actually, I think it was one giant desk with one large cut through for legs, and it allows you to write with a partner rather well. And so my husband and I have set up our desks like this. We have matching desks, and it works out very nicely. And the room's quite cozy. And then this afternoon, I built a smaller desk to go into the, it's the guest room / spinning fiber, dyeing, sewing machine workroom. But, you know, it has a bed in it with a trundle bed, so if people come to stay, they can stay there. And that's starting to get organized, although I have to figure out how exactly to organize all my pieces. You know, when you sew and you cross stitch and you spin and you knit and you crochet and you pretend that you can draw and paint, it's a lot of stuff. And I don't know that I have any business having this much stuff. I don't have a very large yarn stash. I just have tools. It all comes down to having the right tools, which I learned this week when I put in a new faucet. Can I just share with you right now that for the rest of my life, I will happily pay a plumber to do anything. It could be changing a screw. I don't care. If it's under a sink, I'm going to find a way to pay someone. I bought myself a faucet because our kitchen is really pretty hideous and very small, and the sink is very small, and there was no little sprayer thingy. And while it's very nice moving out of New York to be able to have a garbage disposal, it's very hard to have children and not have a sprayer. And so I got myself at Home Depot one of the inexpensive little faucets, kitchen faucets, where you can, the spigot, you know, the part where the water comes out, is also a sprayer. And so you can kind of pull it off the neck of the faucet and spray around. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, all I have to do is turn the water off and take the old one out and put in the new one in. I talked to the guy at Home Depot. This should be easy. And he neglected to tell me that you're working in a really small space with, so much stuff coming out of the faucet, now that it's not just a faucet, it's a whole bunch of tubes and things like that, that there actually aren't any tools that you can use to tighten the nuts to keep the faucet from sliding around. So I went to Ace Hardware because I figured I could talk to one of the Helpville people there. And I talked to a guy and I told him my dilemma. And he said, oh yeah, there's a wrench for that because there aren't any tools that you would have normally that would fit. And I thought, holy cow, this is what my dad has always said. It's always about having the right tool. So he showed me the wrench and I said, you know, this looks kind of big for the very, very small space I have to work in. And he said, no, this is the right one. This is what everyone uses. And I guess I'm either stupid or I'm not everyone because the thing didn't fit. Luckily, I had a sneaking feeling that the thing wasn't going to fit. And so I also bought 4 rubber washers and I cut them when we got home. And I loosened the little metal frame that was pushing up against the bottom of the sink that was actually the thing holding the sink in place and the thing that I couldn't tighten very well. And I slid the rubber washers onto all of those tubes and pipes and things. And then I pushed the little metal plate back up and I was able to tighten it against the rubber washers. And now I have a sink with a faucet that has a squirty hose, and I'm so excited, and I love, and deeply respect plumbers. I never want to do that again. It hurt. And that was the beginning of the other part of our episode title. I did what I could to, you know, maintain good back posture while I was under the sink, but it was difficult, and that was the beginning of the backache. And you know, that coupled with carrying ridiculously heavy boxes all over the house and not having done a sit-up in about 39 years, something happened and my back is in unbelievable pain. It's in spasm, but it hasn't gone out on me. For those of you who have experienced a back going out on you, the pain is extraordinary and it does stop you from breathing. And I was just recently listening to an NPR thing where they were talking about how people are lying about sick days and going into work and stuff, and they're calling in sick with ridiculous excuses like, I sneezed and my back went out. And I looked at my husband and said, that's not a joke. If you're in the wrong position and your back is weak and prone to going out and you sneeze really hard, I've thrown my back out. The other excuse was brushing my teeth. I threw my back out, which is the other way I'd thrown my back out. These people weren't lying. You know, the 15th time your Aunt Gwen dies, yes, you're making stuff up, but your back can go out pretty easily if you don't do sit-ups like I don't do. So I am in... I'm actually on naproxen right now. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's like heavy-duty painkiller plus anti-inflammatory stuff. And so right now I'm not screaming, but the last 2.5 days I have been spending most of my time lying down on a heating pad praying for relief, which comes in the form of naproxen, as I understand it. So, you know, backaches and boxes, and this is what you get for moving. Aside from that, everything is really going well. It's a very, very pleasant place, Tucson, Arizona. And I think everybody should come visit. My husband came up with this idea that we should have at the 1-year podiversary, we should see how many people can hook up somewhere, you know, not too far. I don't know, maybe Phoenix. I don't know where, but he thought maybe we could all get together and read some short stories together and actually talk about books in person, and I could record it and then we could play it for everybody who couldn't come. So I don't know. How many of you could come to Phoenix next April? I don't know. I can probably get there if somebody else is going to come. Maybe Kate and I can drive up together. But I thought that was pretty neat that my husband actually thought that sounded important enough to, you know, check the idea out and see how it played. So now I'm passing it on to you. So we have me and my backache. We have the web links from Nina, which I have put on the show notes. And I also have to share with you, I one of the curricular pieces that I've been working on for work is on parody. And good parodies are very hard to find. Satires are pretty easy to find. You know, you've got the Simpsons, you've got the Colbert Report, you've got all that stuff. Parodies are hard to find. And then my husband reminded me of Weird Al Yankovic. I don't know how many of you listened to any of his wacky songs when you were kids, but this guy knows how to write a parody. And I always respect parodies because they come from a place of love. You can't do a good parody of something you despise. You can make fun of it, but you can't do a really good parody. And Weird Al loves music, and you can tell because he plays music remarkably well. And the thing I have a link to is his song Yoda, which is a parody of the song Lola. And I challenge you, as you're listening, to hear any difference between the music he's playing and the original. He's got a lot of good stuff, and he's a clever guy. And I understand he's fallen on hard times. I heard a rumor about that a while ago, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I think I'm going to have to go buy one of his albums because he made me smile. And the link that I link to is, you know, it's completely goofy, and I hope it makes you smile too. And I hope it makes you smile because the book we're reading is just not going to. And here we are. I ran out of time last week, and I wanted to apologize. I wound up being 11 minutes over, and I had to cut 11 minutes of me blathering out of the show. And so I'm sure that aside from any hissing that you may have heard, you probably also heard some very strange edits. And I'm sorry for that. I actually had to cut out some pretty cool stuff. So I apologize. I won't have that problem today. Today's episodes, the chapters that we're going to listen to are chapters 8 and 9. And the stakes are rising. The governess is positive that the children are either seeing the ghosts or that she's lost the power to see the ghosts and they're appearing to the children without the children saying anything to her. Now, we're in a situation with an unreliable narrator, and that means that you have to do a couple of things. You have to listen to what she's saying, and you have to be fairly hard on her for what she's saying. At the same time, you have to think about how she appears to the other characters in the story. So when Henry James is giving you descriptions of what Mrs. Gross is saying, or how she's looking, or what the children say or do, or how they look, you have to think about who's saying it to you, the governess, and think about why they might be responding the way they do. Because we've talked about the class structure thing. The governess is not going to be contradicted by Mrs. Gross. Along with that, she's also not going to be directly confronted by the children. These are good children, and everybody keeps saying that. They're beautiful, they're sweet, they're good. If you were one of those little girls who always wants to do the right thing, who wants to please the adults who you're with, and the adult is nuts, you're going to be doing a lot of uh-huh, and smiling, and hoping that it will all go away and stop. And if this crazy person says, "You saw that, didn't you?" you're going to say, "Uh-huh," and not mean a word of it. So you have to pay attention to what she's saying, but also the reactions of the people around her. The other interesting point that comes up at this point in the narrative is that we know that she did see, or well, we think she did see someone. And when she described that someone, she described Peter Quint. Now, when she starts talking about Miss Jessel, she's the one who said she saw Miss Jessel, and she's fit her description to what she's heard. So we don't know whether she hasn't seen the ghosts. They might be really real, but you need to listen to her descriptions of the children's play, the way she kind of disdainfully talks about how they have an invitation to romp, as though that's, you know, horror. And she talks about how she so closely watched Miles. It's a little uncomfortable listening to how she's kind of taking her position and the need for her to do a really good job, because of course she's still in love with the guy who hired her, or it's still in deep affection and whatever. So she's starting to slip, and the kids are trying to keep her happy, and you're going to hear more and more of that, but the Quint thing is still a problem, and you're going to get some of that too today. So I leave you with our mystery of the governess and what she is or isn't seeing, because Henry James is not going to give us anything definite. So as much as she may seem like a complete nutball and kind of, you know, allowing her brain to be manipulated by this hysteria, something did happen. She did see someone, and the someone she described was Peter Quint. So, who knows? And on that fun note, I leave you with Nicole Doolin reading The Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
Chapter 8. What I had said to Mrs. Gross was true enough. There were, in the matter I had put before her, depths and possibilities that I lacked resolution to sound, so that when we met once more in the wonder of it, we were of a common mind about the duty of resistance to extravagant fancies. We were to keep our heads if we should keep nothing else, difficult indeed, as that might be in the face of what, in our prodigious experience, was least to be questioned. Late that night, while the house slept, we had another talk in my room, when she went all the way with me, as to its being beyond doubt that I had seen exactly what I had seen. To hold her perfectly in the pinch of that, I found I had only to ask her now if I had made it up. I came to be able to give, of each of the persons appearing to me, a picture disclosing, to the last detail, their special marks. A portrait on the exhibition, of which she had instantly recognized and named them. She wished, of course, small blame to her, to sink the whole subject. And I was quick to assure her that my own interest in it had now violently taken the form of a search for the way to escape from it. I encountered her on the ground of a probability that with recurrence, for recurrence we took for granted, I should get used to my danger, distinctly professing that my personal exposure had suddenly become the least of my discomforts. It was my new suspicion that was intolerable. And yet even to this complication, the later hours of the day had brought a little ease. On leaving her, after my first outbreak, I had of course returned to my pupils, associating the right remedy for my dismay with that sense of their charm which I had already found to be a thing I could positively cultivate, and which had never failed me yet. I had simply, in other words, plunged afresh into Flora's special society, and there become aware it was almost a luxury that she could put her little conscious hand straight upon the spot that ached. She had looked at me in sweet speculation, and then had accused me to my face of having cried. I had supposed I had brushed away the ugly signs, but I could literally, for the time, at all events, rejoice under this fathomless charity that they had not entirely disappeared. To gaze into the depths of blue of the child's eyes and pronounce their loveliness a trick of premature cunning was to be guilty of a cynicism, in preference to which I naturally preferred to abjure my judgment. And so far as might be, my agitation, I couldn't abjure for merely wanting to, but I could repeat to Mrs. Gross, as I did there, over and over, in the small hours, that with their voices in the air, their pressure on one's heart, and their fragrant faces against one's cheek, everything fell to the ground, but their incapacity and their beauty. It was a pity that, somehow, to settle this once for all, I had equally to re-enumerate the signs of subtlety that, in the afternoon, by the lake, had made a miracle of my show of self-possession. It was a pity to be obliged to reinvestigate the certitude of the moment itself, and repeat how it had come to me, as a revelation that the inconceivable communion I then surprised was a matter for either party of habit. It was a pity that I should have had to quaver out again the reasons for my not having, in my delusion, so much as questioned that the little girl saw our visitant, even as I actually saw Mrs. Gross herself, and that she wanted, by just so much as she did thus see, to make me suppose she didn't, and at the same time, without showing anything, arrive at a guess as to whether I myself did. It was a pity that I needed once more to describe the portentous little activity by which she sought to divert my attention, the perceptible increase of movement, the greater intensity of play, the singing, the gabbling of nonsense, and the invitation to romp. Yet if I had not indulged, to prove there was nothing in it, in this review, I should have missed the two or three dim elements of comfort that still remain to me. I should not, for the instance, have been able to asseverate to my friend that I was certain, which was so much to the good, that I at least had not betrayed myself. I should not have been prompted by stress of need, by desperation of mind, I scarce know what to call it, to invoke such further aid to intelligence as might spring from pushing my colleague fairly to the wall. She had told me, bit by bit, under pressure, a great deal. But a small, shifty spot on the wrong side of it all still sometimes brushed my brow like the wing of a bat. And I remember how on this occasion, for the sleeping house and the concentration alike of our danger and our watch seemed to help, I felt the importance of giving the last jerk to the curtain. "I don't believe anything so horrible," I recollect saying. "No, let us put it definitely, my dear, that I don't. But if I did, you know, there's a thing I should require now. Just without sparing you the least bit more. Oh, not a scrap, come, to get out of you. What was it you had in mind when, in our distress, before Miles came back, over the letter from his school, you said, under my insistence, that you didn't pretend for him that he had not literally ever been bad. He has not literally ever, in these weeks that I have myself lived with him, and so closely watched him, he has been an imperturbable little prodigy of delightful, lovable goodness. Therefore you might perfectly have made the claim for him if you had not, as it happened, seen an exception to take. What was your exception? And to what passage in your personal observation of him did you refer? It was a dreadfully austere inquiry, But levity was not our note, and at any rate, before the gray dawn admonished us to separate, I had got my answer. What my friend had had in mind proved to be immensely to the purpose. It was neither more nor less than the circumstance that for a period of several months, Quint and the boy had been perpetually together. It was, in fact, the very appropriate truth that she had ventured to criticize the propriety, to hint at the incongruity, of so close an alliance, and even to go so far on the subject as a frank overture to Miss Jessel. Miss Jessel had, with a most strange manner, requested her to mind her business, and the good woman had, on this, directly approached little Miles. What she had said to him, since I pressed, was that she liked to see young gentlemen not forget their station. I pressed again, of course, at this. You reminded him that Quint was only a base menial? As you might say, and it was his answer for one thing that was bad. And for another thing? I waited. He repeated your words to Quint? No, not that. It's just what he wouldn't. She could still impress upon me. I was sure, at any rate, she added, that he didn't. But he denied certain occasions. What occasions? When they had been about together quite as if Quint were his tutor, and a very grand one. And Miss Jessel only for the little lady. When he had gone off with the fellow, I mean, and spent hours with him. He then prevaricated about it. He said he hadn't. Her assent was clear enough to cause me to add in a moment, I see. He lied. Oh, Mrs. Gross mumbled. This was a suggestion that it didn't matter, which indeed she backed up by a further remark. You see, after all, Miss Jessel didn't mind. She didn't forbid him. I considered. Did he put that to you as a justification? At this she dropped again. No, he never spoke of it. Never mentioned her in connection with Quint? She saw, visibly flushing, where I was coming out. Well, he didn't show anything. He denied, she repeated. He denied. Lord, how I pressed her now, so that you could see he knew what he was between the two wretches. I don't know, the poor woman groaned. You do know, you dear thing, I replied. Only you haven't my dreadful boldness of mind, and you keep back, out of timidity and modesty and delicacy, even the impression that, in the past, when you had, without my aid, to flounder about in silence, most of all made you miserable. But I shall get it out of you yet. There was something in the boy that suggested to you, I continued, that he covered and concealed their relation. Oh, he couldn't prevent your learning the truth, I dare say. But heavens, I fell with vehemence a-thinking, what it shows that they must, to that extent, have succeeded in making of him. Ah, nothing that's not nice now, Mrs. Gross lugubriously pleaded. I don't wonder you looked queer, I persisted, when I mentioned to you the letter from his school. I doubt if I looked as queer as you, she retorted with homely force. And if he was so bad then as that comes to, how is he such an angel now? Yes, indeed. And if he was a fiend at school, how? Well, I said in my torment, You must put it to me again. But I shall not be able to tell you for some days. Only, put it to me again. I cried in a way that made my friend stare. There are directions in which I must not for the present let myself go. Meanwhile, I returned to her first example, the one to which she had just previously referred, of the boy's happy capacity for an occasional slip. If Quint, on your remonstrance at the time you speak of, was a base menial, one of the things Miles said to you, I find myself guessing, was that you were another. Again, her admission was so adequate that I continued. And you forgave him that? Wouldn't you? Oh, yes. And we exchanged there, in the stillness, a sound of the oddest amusement. Then I went on. At all events, while he was with the man, Miss Flora was with the woman. It suited them all. It suited me, too, I felt, only too well, by which I mean that it suited exactly the particularly deadly view I was in the very act of forbidding myself to entertain. But I so far succeeded in checking the expression of this view that I will throw, just here, no further light on it than may be offered by the mention of my final observation to Mrs. Gross. His having lied and been impudent are, I confess, less engaging specimens than I had hoped to have from you, of the outbreak in him of the little natural man. Still, I mused, they must do, for they make me feel more than ever that I must watch. It made me blush the next minute to see in my friend's face how much more unreservedly she had forgiven him than her anecdote struck me as presenting to my own tenderness an occasion for doing. This came out when, at the schoolroom door, she quitted me. Surely you don't accuse him of carrying on an intercourse that he conceals from me? Ah, remember that, until further evidence, I now accuse nobody. Then, before shutting her out to go, by another passage, to her own place, I must just wait, I wound up. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9. I waited and waited, and the days, as they elapsed, took something from my consternation. A very few of them, in fact, passing in constant sight of my pupils, without a fresh incident, suffice to give to grievous fancies, and even to odious memories, a kind of brush of the sponge. I have spoken of the surrender to their extraordinary childish grace as a thing I could actively cultivate. And it may be imagined, if I neglected now to address myself to this source for whatever it would yield, stranger than I can express, certainly, was the effort to struggle against my new lights. It would doubtless have been, however, a greater tension still, had it not been so frequently successful. I used to wonder how my little charges could help guessing that I thought strange things about them, and the circumstances that these things only made them more interesting was not by itself a direct aid to keeping them in the dark. I trembled lest they should see that they were so immensely more interesting. Putting things at the worst, at all events, as in meditation I so often did, any clouding of their innocence could only be, blameless and foredoomed as they were, a reason the more for taking risks. There were moments when, by an irresistible impulse, I found myself catching them up and pressing them to my heart. As soon as I had done so, I used to say to myself, "What will they think of that? Doesn't it betray too much?" It would have been easy to get into a sad, wild tangle about how much I might betray, but the real account, I feel, of the hours of peace that I could still enjoy, was that the immediate charm of my companions was a beguilement still effective, even under the shadow of the possibility that it was studied. For if it occurred to me that I might occasionally excite suspicion by the little outbreaks of my sharper passion for them, so too, I remember, wondering if I mightn't see a queerness in the traceable increase of their own demonstrations. They were at this period extravagantly and preternaturally fond of me, which, after all, I could reflect, was no more than a graceful response in children, perpetually bowed over and hugged. The homage of which they were so lavish succeeded, in truth, for my nerves, quite as well as if I never appeared to myself, as I may say, literally to catch them at a purpose in it. They had never, I think, wanted to do so many things for their poor protectress, I mean, though they got their lessons better and better, which was naturally what would please her most, in the way of diverting, entertaining, surprising her, reading her passages, telling her stories, acting her charades, pouncing out at her in disguises as animals and historical characters, and above all astonishing her by the pieces they had secretly got by heart and could interminably recite. I should never get to the bottom, were I to let myself go even now, of the prodigious private commentary, all under still more private correction, with which, in these days, I overscored their full hours. They had shown me from the first a facility for everything, a general faculty which, taking a fresh start, achieved remarkable flights. They got their little tasks as if they loved them, and indulged, from the mere exuberance of the gift, in the most unimposed little miracles of memory. They not only popped out at me as tigers and as Romans, but as Shakespeareans, astronomers, and navigators. This was so singularly the case that it had presumably much to do with the fact as to which, at the present day, I am at a loss for a different explanation. I allude to my unnatural composure on the subject of another school for Miles. What I remember is that I was content not, for the time, to open the question. And that contentment must have sprung from the sense of his perpetually striking show of cleverness. He was too clever for a bad governess, for a parson's daughter, to spoil. And the strangest, if not the brightest thread in the pensive embroidery I just spoke of, was the impression I might have got, if I had dared to work it out, that he was under some influence, operating in his small, intellectual life, as a tremendous incitement. If it was easy to reflect, however, that such a boy could postpone school, it was at least as marked that for such a boy to have been kicked out by a schoolmaster was a mystification without end. Let me add that in their company now, and I was careful almost never to be out of it, I could follow no scent very far. We lived in a cloud of music and love and success and private theatricals. The musical sense in each of the children was of the quickest, but the elder in especial had a marvelous knack of catching and repeating. The schoolroom piano broke into all gruesome fancies, and when that failed, There were confabulations and corners, with a sequel of one of them going out in the highest spirits in order to come in as something new. I had had brothers myself, and it was no revelation to me that little girls could be slavish idolaters of little boys. What surpassed everything was that there was a little boy in the world who could have, for the inferior age, sex and intelligence so fine a consideration. They were extraordinarily at one, and to say that they never either quarreled or complained is to make the note of praise coarse for their quality of sweetness. Sometimes, indeed, when I dropped into coarseness, I perhaps came across traces of little understandings between them, by which one of them should keep me occupied while the other slipped away. There is a naive side, I suppose, in all diplomacy, but if my pupils practiced upon me, it was surely with the minimum of grossness. It was all in their other quarter that, after a lull, the grossness broke out. I find that I really hang back, but I must take my plunge. In going on with the record of what was hideous at Bly, I not only challenge the most liberal faith, for which I little care, but, and this is another matter, I renew what I myself suffered. I again push my way through it to the end. There came suddenly, an hour after which, as I look back, the affair seems to me to have been all pure suffering. But I have at least reached the heart of it, and the straightest road out is doubtless to advance. One evening, with nothing to lead up or to prepare it, I felt the cold touch of the impression that had breathed on me the night of my arrival, and which, much lighter than, as I have mentioned, I should probably have made little of in memory, had my subsequent sojourn been less agitated. I had not gone to bed. I sat reading by a couple of candles. There was a roomful of old books at Bly, last century fiction, some of it which, to the extent of a distinctly deprecated renown, but never to so much as that of a stray specimen, had reached the sequestered home and appealed to the unavowed curiosity of my youth. I remember that the book I had in my hand was Fielding's Amelia, also that I was wholly awake. I recall further both a general conviction that it was horribly late and a particular objection to looking at my watch. I figure, finally, that the white curtain draping, in the fashion of those days, the head of Flora's little bed, shrouded, as I had assured myself long before, the perfection of childish rest. I recollect, in short, that though I was deeply interested in my author, I found myself at the turn of a page, and with his spell all scattered, looking straight up from him and hard at the door of my room. There was a moment during which I listened, reminded of the faint sense I had had, the first night, of there being something undefinably astir in the house, and noted the soft breath of the open casement just move the half-drawn blind. Then, with all the marks of a deliberation that must have seemed magnificent had there been anyone to admire it, I laid down my book, rose to my feet, and taking a candle, went straight out of the room, and from the passage on which my light made little impression, noiselessly closed and locked the door. I can say now neither what determined nor what guided me, but I went straight along the lobby, holding my candle high, till I came within sight of the tall window that presided over the great turn of the staircase. At this point, I precipitately found myself aware of three things. They were practically simultaneous, yet they had flashes of succession. My candle, under a bold flourish, went out, and I perceived, by the uncovered window, that the yielding dusk of earliest morning rendered it unnecessary. Without it, the next instant, I saw that there was someone on the stair. I speak of sequences, but I required no lapse of seconds to stiffen myself for a third encounter with Quint. The apparition had reached the landing halfway up, and was therefore on the spot nearest the window, where at sight of me, it stopped short and fixed me exactly as it had fixed me from the tower and from the garden. He knew me as well as I knew him. And so, in the cold, faint twilight, with a glimmer in the high glass and another on the polish of the oak stair below, we faced each other in our common intensity. He was absolutely, on this occasion, a living, detestable, dangerous presence. But that was not the wonder of wonders. I reserve this distinction for quite another circumstance. The circumstance that dread had unmistakably quitted me, and that there was nothing in me there that didn't meet and measure him. I had plenty of anguish after the extraordinary moment, but I had, thank God, no terror, and he knew I had not. I found myself at the end of an instant magnificently aware of this. I felt, in a fierce rigor of confidence, that if I stood my ground a minute, I should cease, for the time, at least, to have him to reckon with. And during the minute, accordingly, the thing was as human and hideous as a real interview. Hideous just because it was human. As human as to have met alone, in the small hours, in a sleeping house, some enemy, some adventurer, some criminal. It was the dead silence of our long gaze at such close quarters that gave the whole horror, huge as it was, its only note of the unnatural. If I had met a murderer in such a place and at such an hour, we still at least would have spoken. Something would have passed in life between us. If nothing had passed, one of us would have moved. The moment was not so prolonged that it would have taken but little more to make me doubt if even I were in life. I can't express what followed it, save by saying that the silence itself, which was indeed in a manner an attestation of my strength, became the element into which I saw the figure disappear, in which I definitely saw it turn, as I might have seen the low wretch to which it had once belonged turn on receipt of an order, and pass with my eyes on the villainous back that no hunch could have more disfigured, straight down the staircase and into the darkness in which the next bend was lost. End of chapter 9.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's chapters. I think the book is good. And now I'm wondering what we should do after this. Gosh, maybe I should try and find something funny. I'll probably do more short stories after we're done with Turn of the Screw. But I hope you're enjoying it. It certainly has. I've started noticing for me that I'm starting to see people on TV, people in movies, personalities, in terms of how the players in the story work. And that's always kind of cool. I think anytime you kind of get haunted by a story like that, where it stays with you, the writer did something right. Well, I haven't had any other life this week, so I don't have any stories to tell you, but I do have knitting to tell you about, which I didn't do before the chapters. I have been working furiously on socks and Christmas presents, and I have managed to get some of the Christmas presents done, which I'm rather awed by. But I also, at my friend Paula from SOAR, who was in my SOAR spinning class, she mentioned the six socks knit along, and so I joined up. And the whole idea is you have to knit six socks during the year based on patterns that that are uploaded to the group website. And you have to upload one picture of sock in progress and then your socks when they're complete. Well, I'm about two-thirds of the way done with my first sock, and it's wonderful. It's this really neat kind of supportive group where you all get to, you know, it's just socks. There's none of the chit-chat. There's none of the chatter. You really are just talking about the socks. And the pattern that they were doing when I first signed up at the end of November was stunning. I'm fearful of doing it. I want to go back and do it, but ye gods, it was this amazing Fair Isle sock, and everybody was saying, oh, I have to knit it with bigger needles. Pulled my stitches too tight, but it looks like one of those, if you've ever gone to Blue Moon Fiber Arts to show off their Socks That Rock socks, they have these amazing Fair Isle bobbled socks. This was kind of like that. And I haven't had the courage to try yet. I will, but some of it is also finding the right yarn. And I don't have that yarn in my stash right now. So I'm thinking. But the second pattern that came on while I was part of this group, the December pattern, is lovely. It's low-key, it's doing these little slip stitch chains. It couldn't be easier. It's nice for knitting when your back is killing you. It's, you know, not heavy. And sadly, you know, I'm going to give these socks away for a gift. The thing that I've had to stop knitting on is my hoodie, my cabled hoodie. And that's making me sad because I know the cold weather here is pretty short-lived, and I'm just working on the hood. I haven't even started the sleeves, and I'm just so convinced that this is not going to happen for this winter. So I'm kind of sad about that. I'm also a little sad because last year we started the podcast too late for me to share my woes with you about the Knitting Olympics. I may have talked about this early on. I don't remember. It's been so long. But I did join the Knitting Olympics. And actually, when I met Stephanie Pearl McPhee at SOAR, I was able to introduce myself to her by telling her what I had signed up to do. And her response was, oh my God, that was you? I signed up to knit the Vogue 2002 Map of the World Afghan, and I would have had time to finish it because I was actually cruising on the Intarsia. I was doing pretty well. And then the Friday the Olympics started, I got called in to work down in New York City, so I had to get on the train every day and go work long hours and come home late. And then, you know, it was the kids. And then I had to work at night at home. This project blew up and I had to, anyway. So I wound up with a grand total of about 8 hours in 2 weeks to knit. So I didn't just fail, I failed spectacularly. I finished one of the four panels and I got past Argentina on the South America panel, and that was it. And so I had said, well, I'll put it away. And it's winter knitting. It's very heavy, heavy worsted weight, tweed, tockley tweed, heathered tweed yarn. It hurts. It's such a strong yarn. It actually did hurt my poor little fingers, which are already wrecks. So I thought to myself, well, that's fine. This is going to be winter knitting. And then we moved to Tucson. I don't know when I'm going to finish that either, and it's making me sad. But, you know, there's air conditioning, so I guess I could spin a knit. I'm also about to embark on spinning a bunch of purple heathered roving for my friend Sam so I can knit her daughter this really cute hoodie sweater out of the holiday knits. I knit the guy at work, I think I told you, the skull sweater for his child. Well, now there's another girl at work who just got pregnant, and her husband teaches at West Point, so I want to knit an army sweatshirt hoodie thing for the baby, you know, like a little six-month-old army thing on the back. And I looked at the logos for the army, and there's not a chance I'm going to be able to knit a logo, so I think I'm just going to knit the words army. I just have to find the right font and then figure out how to chart them. If anybody has seen those things charted, give me a heads up at mamaoknits@gmail.com. That would be so cool. Anyway, I hope that Henry James sits with you this week and the governess haunts your dreams. And we'll do more of the nutty governess next week, because I promised you I'm not taking a week off between now and the new year. It's not fair. I hope you all have great weeks, and I'll talk to you in a week. Have a good one. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.